Okay, I believe everyone should have heard that. The conference is now being recorded. Sarah, I'm turning it over to you.
Great. Well, thank you, Sandra, and good morning. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for being here. I'm Sarah Barzak. I'm the Program Director with Southern Alliance for Clean Energy of our High-Risk Energy Choices Program. Sandra, if you could advance to the next slide, please. Thank you for attending today. We are very pleased to connect with you because you make our work possible. This webinar is a great opportunity to learn and ask questions. A little bit about ourselves here, Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. You can see our slide. Most of you are pretty familiar with us, but we've been around for 25 years working on a lot of aspects of energy policy in the Southeast and started this webinar series, I believe it's about 2 years ago now, and we have a couple each month. Sandra, if you can advance to the next slide, Ellen's cover slide. We have excellent presenters today who will discuss a recently released report, Big Risks, Better Alternatives, which delves into two new nuclear reactor projects here in the Southeast. First up is Ellen Banco. Ellen is the Nuclear Energy and Climate Change Project Manager for the Union of Concerned Scientists in Washington, D.C., where she directs UCS research and policy analysis concerning the viability of nuclear power as a potential climate solution. Ellen also serves as UCS's senior advisor on federal and state policies concerning electricity markets, transmission system planning and operations, and the reliable integration of renewable energy and demand-side resources into the electric system. Ellen has more than 25 years of experience working on energy issues for industry and nonprofit organizations at the state, federal, and international levels. Prior to coming to UCS, Ellen was Director of Communications and Government Affairs for the North American Electric Reliability Council, directed policy analysis for Allegheny Energy and the Edison Electric Institute, and has served as an energy consultant on a range of energy issues for government and industry. She holds a BA in political science from George Washington University and an MS in energy management and policy from the University of Pennsylvania. I've heard a lot of beeping, so I think we've got some more people joining. This is Sarah Barzak with Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. I'm just introducing our speakers. As I said, first will be Ellen Banco from Union of Concerned Scientists. And then after Ellen, we will hear from Max Tang, an associate with Synapse Energy Economics, who prepared the report. Mr. Tang provides economic analysis of technologies and policies, performs electric policy modeling, and evaluates air emissions of electricity generation. He works on energy efficiency, consumer advocacy, environmental compliance, and technology strategy projects within the energy industry. He has conducted analysis and utility rate cases focusing on reliability metrics and infrastructure issues. Max has also analyzed the benefits and costs of electric and natural gas energy efficiency measures and programs and has testified in Massachusetts supporting the development of the Cape Light Compact 3-year energy efficiency plan. He has also co-authored the 2009 and 2011 New England Avoided Energy Supply Cost Study used by New England Energy Efficiency Program Administrators to develop energy efficiency plans. Prior to joining Synapse, Max Tain was a senior scientist at Environmental Health and Engineering. He holds a Master's of Environmental Science and Engineering from Harvard and a Bachelor of Arts from Cornell. We'd like to let Ellen start and then Max go second, and to have both of them get through their presentations before taking questions. And with that, let me turn the presentation over to Ellen. Ellen?
Thank you very much, Sarah, and thank you, everybody, for joining us today. I hope this report will be of interest. You can go to the next slide, please, Chandra. Just a brief commercial about UCS. We are the leading science-based nonprofit organization in the United States, working for a healthy environment and a safer world. We were founded in 1969, and we're headquartered in Cambridge, but have offices in Washington, Berkeley, and Chicago. I deal primarily, as Sarah explained, with nuclear economics in this aspect of our nuclear work at UCS. We also focus on safety and security issues as well. Next slide. We commissioned Synapse to prepare the study Big Risks, Better Alternatives, because, as you know, there's a lot of attention being paid to the development of new reactors in the southeastern United States, and we chose at the time to focus on you know, two very similar but also very different projects, the Vogtle Power Plant in Georgia, which is the addition of two AP1000 nuclear reactors at an existing nuclear facility, and Levy 1 and 2, which is a greenfield proposal for new nuclear development in Central Florida on the Gulf Coast. There are a lot of similarities, as Max will discuss later, and there are also a lot of differences, but we wanted to point out in both cases that there were alternatives that were cleaner, faster, and less risky to these proposed projects. Both of these projects were proposed at a time when energy demand was expected to rise significantly. That was prior to the recession and downturn in most areas of the country, but which effectively hit the Southeast and particularly Florida very hard. So we also had Synapse compare these projects to on a relative basis to other low carbon alternatives that we believed could do the job at a lower cost and a lower risk. And I'll just briefly go to the key findings. Chandra, you can move on of the report, and then Max will go into the details of how we set up the report, how we got there, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. Obviously, the risks associated with Levy and Vogtle are really no different than the risks associated with any other nuclear plant construction or large-scale capital cost project. And that gets into the issues of cost escalation, construction, and regulatory delays, and a lack of transparency with projects like this in terms of what the projected costs are versus what the costs actually turn out to be. And we think these plants continue to provide risks in all of these areas, no different than the first generation of nuclear reactors did. We believe that the cost estimates of both plants are going to increase dramatically, probably more so with Vogtle than with Levy, just because Vogtle's sticking to a 2000-2007 cost estimate, and meanwhile, all other nuclear projects that have been announced since then have seen rapid and dramatic increases in the estimated cost of those projects, and Levy is one example of that. Our main conclusion from the report is that both Florida and Georgia have room to significantly improve their energy efficiency investments. The latest ACEEE study showed Georgia ranking 36th and Florida ranking 27th among states across a whole range of energy efficiency categories. The other thing we point out in this report that is that neither Florida nor Georgia have implemented renewable energy portfolio requirements. But studies have shown that they have significant renewable resource potential that can be exploited at a much more economic basis than the nuclear reactors and on a much more scalable level. So, again, our findings that our takeaway from the report is that ratepayers in both states will be better served by investing in clean and lower cost energy efficiency and available renewable energy. With that, I would like to turn the gavel over to Max, but with the last slide, just for your information, is some other salient research we've done on the issue of economics and safety and security, and it can be found on the UCS website if you can't click through to the links on this presentation. So with that, Max?
Thank you, Ellen, and thank you, Sarah and Chandra and SAIS and UCS for allowing us the opportunity to discuss the findings of this report that we're pretty excited about. And next slide. So just to provide a more in-depth sort of overview of what Ellen just summarized, the structure of my presentation is sort of just to follow the sort of introduction background, some information about Vogtle 3 and 4, Levy 1 and 2, and discuss sort of the subsidies for Vogtle 3 and 4 that really are some of the big differences between that proposed project and the Levy 1 and 2, the impact on ratepayers of both projects, and then to discuss better alternatives to these two projects. First, energy efficiency, and second, renewable energy, and then to summarize conclusions and recommendations. Next slide, please. Just to give you a background about Synapse Energy Economics, we are a consulting firm specializing in energy system modeling analysis, expert testimony, and stakeholder representation. We primarily focus, almost predominantly focus on working for consumer advocates and nonprofit foundations. We also work with PUCs and attorney generals and environmental foundations. You can find more information about us and the actual link to this report at our website, and it's the link is right there at the bottom. Next slide. Just as way of background to the report, the current state of nuclear power in the United States, importantly, no plant has been ordered since the 1970s. There are 104 reactors currently operating in the United States, and combined these generate about 20% of the electricity in the United States. Next slide. And going to from the current state of nuclear power, we now go to sort of the newly proposed projects across the country. And this chart is taken from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's website, and it shows the location and actually type of plants being proposed. Currently, there are 18 applications for 28 reactors. We want to note that 8 of those reactors have either been suspended because the project team has realized that they are no longer viable projects, or and effectively it has reduced the number of reactors by 8. And sort of just highlighting those points, NRG has canceled its South Texas project. Exelon has abandoned Victoria County 1 and 2. And Unistar has is looking for a partner to develop Calvert Cliffs in Unit 3 in Maryland. And I want to note that these three particular projects are all from merchant builders, which are not, which is slightly different than the situation in Georgia and Florida, where you have vertically integrated utilities proposing to build nuclear power plants. And I think that's a very important distinction to make. Next slide. As Ellen sort of noted briefly, sort of the really interesting thing about this paper was that we sort of took the opportunity to look at two plants that are in many ways similar but different. And I think those differences and similarities are useful to apply to the other state. For instance, when looking at Levy 1 and 2 and Vogtle 3 and 4, they both are the same type of reactor design. They're both similarly sized. They're both in states with favorable regulatory environments. And they were both announced in 2006. Where there are differences between the two proposed projects are Levy 1 and 2 is a greenfield site, as Ellen mentioned. Vogtle 3 and 4 will be built next to Vogtle 1 and 2. And there are significant subsidies available for Vogtle 3 and 4 that are not available for Levy 1 and 2, notably the federal loan guarantee and the production tax credit. And these all have an impact on the cost estimate. And that chart sort of highlights some sort of summary of sort of differences and similarities. The other thing to note is that Vogtle 3 and 4, Georgia Power only owns a portion of that particular project, whereas Levy 1 and 2 is 100% owned by Progress Energy of Florida. Next slide, please. Next slide.
I'm next. Excuse me. Yeah, it's coming. Just a moment. I'm sorry about that.
Okay.
There it goes. Just a little freezing on my end. Sorry about that for everybody.
It's okay. So to take a step back, the AP1000 is one of the new designs. It's a Generation 3 reactor, and the intent of the design is that the nuclear industry sort of learned painfully that by having each individual reactor designed for each particular individual location, that resulted or that helped contribute to some of the cost overruns experienced by the nuclear power industry back in the 70s and 80s. So to address that, one thought and one solution was to create a modular design so that every AP1000 reactor would be the same regardless of location. And the intent of that was to sort of streamline the design process, streamline the approval process. But it's important to note that the only units being under construction right now, in significant construction, are in China, and that they have not been built in the U.S. And for that matter, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has not issued a final design certification for the AP1000. Originally, it was thought, and it still may be issued by the end of this year, but that is unknown currently. Next slide, please. So to start with Vogtle 3 and 4, as I noted, Georgia Power owns a portion of that. It is in a consortium with Oglethorpe Power, a consortium of municipal MEAG, and the City of Dalton. It is, as you can see from this overview slide, it is right next to the existing site of Vogtle 1 and 2. The two units are 1,100 megawatts each for a combined total of 2,200 megawatts. Georgia Power has stuck with its construction schedule of 2016 for Unit 3 and 2017, and it has not changed its published cost estimate for the plant of $14.1 billion. Of that, Georgia Power's share is $6.1 billion. Next slide. And I'm not going to read through sort of all of the timeline and sort of milestone events, but the point here of this slide is to show that Georgia Power has not changed its estimates or its schedule since it's announced the development of this project, and that is taking into account all the events that have happened sort of regionally, nationally, since 2006. We've had a significant recession, load has slowed or decreased in Georgia, and yet Georgia Power has not sort of budged as far as cost estimates or schedule. And in fact, what this does is this made our analysis a little bit difficult, because if you go into the Georgia Public Service Commission's filings, Georgia Power has marked trade secret to basically all cost information related to the plant and schedules. So what we did, next slide. Was to arrive at some sort of cost estimate range for the project, and what we did was we took the Georgia Power published cost estimate of $14.1 billion and used that as our low range estimate, and then to inform our mid case and high estimate, what we did was we took the historical experience of Vogtle 1 and 2, which in nominal dollars was originally scheduled to cost $660 million, but the final cost was $8.8 billion. And what we did was we converted that to real dollars just to stay consistent from an analytical standpoint, and the cost increase of Vogtle 1 and 2 in real dollar terms was 300%. So giving Georgia Power some credit and some leeway, we said that, they probably learned from their lesson from Vogtle 1 and 2, and so our high estimate was 200% of the current cost, and our mid-case estimate was one half of that increase. So that gave us our low, mid, and high range, and the following table right next to it sort of summarizes the comparison of the Vogtle mid-range cost to alternatives, which include energy efficiency, natural gas combined cycle, biomass, onshore wind, coal, offshore wind, and solar PV. And you can see in the table that the mid-range cost of Vogtle 3 and 4 is higher than the energy efficiency, natural gas, biomass, onshore wind, and coal, although it is cheaper in this table than offshore wind and solar PV. The last line, Chandra, if you can sort of highlight the tax credit line right there, the second to last line, that sort of shows the impact of this production tax credit, one of the two subsidies that Vogtle 3 and 4 is planning, we've assumed to receive in our analysis. Next slide, please. Switching over to Levy 1 and 2, and this sort of shows an overview map of the proposed site. It is a greenfield site, and it is, again, 2,200 megawatts in total, whereas with Vogtle 3 and 4, the construction schedule and the project cost estimate has not changed. This is dramatically different for Levy 1 and 2. If you go to the next slide. Unlike the previous table for timeline table for Vogtle 3 and 4, Levy has experienced progress has made numerous announcements changing the schedule, changing the cost estimate for this particular project. Originally, in 2006, they were looking at one unit and they were looking at a 2016 delivery date. Since then, they have gradually shifted the cost estimate or significantly increased the cost estimate to $17 billion. And then in 2010, the schedule changed from 2016 and 2018 to 2019, 2021. And finally, the cost estimate has jumped from $17 billion to $22.5 billion. And the proposed completion of the two units has been pushed back even further to 2021 and 2023. Next slide.
Yeah, patience, please. We are trying to get this slide to move forward. I believe, is that it, Max?
That's it, slide 13.
Okay.
So where we had very limited or redacted information for Vogtle 3 and 4, we have sort of at least a more detailed information provided by Progress Energy Florida. Certainly in their filings to the Florida Commission, they have provided cost estimates both in the docket for the particular project and actually provided in Progress Energy Florida's 10-year site plan that they provide to the state every year. So we actually had some very good information provided for Levy 1 and 2. And using that information, again, for the low estimate, we just took the current cost estimate. And then for the high estimate, we assumed that the cost increases experienced from 2010 through 2011, the 30% increase would continue to provide the high-end range, and the mid-case range was just one-half of that. And I want to be clear that our ranges aren't necessarily where we think the actual costs of the projects are, but in the absence of ranges provided by both Progress Energy and Georgia Power, we feel it's important to present this so that there is a sort of a range of costs that can be shown, and I think this is something that has not been available in the debate about these two proposed projects, is that everyone has seen what the company has provided, but no one has seen sort of a, if you will, what they provided is the most optimistic case scenario, but there needs to be some healthy skepticism in their cost estimates, and that's what we've sort of tried to provide with these mid case and high estimate ranges. And so, so from here you can see that the range for the levy costs, sorry, I'm still on slide 13, is again higher. Nope, that's all right. It is higher than the other alternatives with the exception of offshore wind and solar PV. And again, this particular table shows technologies without subsidies, since in our analysis, Levy 1 and 2 did not receive any subsidies. So if you go to the next slide.
Do you want to explain why that is, Max?
Yes. Levy 1 and 2 in our analysis, and actually I'll go into a little more detail two slides from now when I talk about the subsidies. So maybe I'll just table it for that.
Okay.
So this chart actually shows both the mid-case scenarios for Vogtle 3 and 4 and Levy 1 and 2 compared to the alternatives. And if you look at the very top white bar, sort of it shows up in the biomass, the wind onshore, the wind offshore, solar PV, and Vogtle, those are the impacts of the production tax credit. That is one of the subsidies that Vogtle is assumed to receive in our analysis that Levy does not receive. And the impact of the production tax credit is it effectively lowers the levelized cost for the projects. So where wind offshore and solar PV were sort of in that high range in that previous slide, when you take into account the production tax credit, it reduces those costs, the all-in costs. Next slide. And this is the discussion about the subsidies. The two subsidies that Vogtle 3 and 4 are assumed to receive are A, the federal loan guarantee, which was announced in February 2010. Georgia Power and its consortium will receive sort of $8.33 billion in a DOE loan guarantee. What it effectively does is it allows Georgia Power to borrow at below market rates. And in our analysis, what it does is it allows Georgia Power to increase the debt fraction of the cost of the plant. So rather than using expensive equity, it now can use cheaper debt. And actually, Chandra, if you go back to the previous slide, just changing the assumption of the loan guarantee would increase the all-in cost of Vogtle from $115 per megawatt hour to approximately $145 per megawatt hour, just the impact of the loan guarantee. So what it would do is it would basically raise the cost of Vogtle to close to the $150 mark by taking out the loan guarantee. Next slide. Back to the next slide. The other subsidy that Vogtle is assumed to receive in our analysis is the production tax credit, which I've sort of alluded to in prior slides. It allows Georgia Power to receive 1.8 cents per kWh for the first 1,000 megawatts. It's capped at $125 million per year for the first 8 years of production. And the reason why it is assumed to occur for Vogtle 3 and 4 and not for Levy 1 and 2 is that under the current guidelines, the production tax credit for nuclear power is through December 31st, 2020. So since in our analysis, we assumed that Levy 1 and 2 would not come online until after 2020, that's why we assumed that it would not receive the production tax credit, whereas Vogtle 3 and 4 receives it. Next slide, please. So what this means for ratepayers in Georgia and Florida, one of the unique or one of the circumstances for ratepayers in Georgia and Florida is that there is regulation in both states, or actually legislation, I apologize, in both states that allow the utilities to recover financing costs in Georgia and financing and some construction costs in Florida while the plants are being built, or in this case, even before being built. We're, in the case of Georgia, they're just moving dirt, and in Florida, there is some sort of design costs that are being passed to ratepayers. So the impact that we've sort of estimated is actually based on announcements by both companies, and it's based on the current cost estimate. If the costs go higher, these impacts would be higher. For Georgia Power, it's the recovery of financing costs, and Georgia Power in its website actually estimates that the impact on ratepayers is $120 per year by 2018 for a customer that's using approximately 1,000 kilowatt hours per month. Obviously, if you use more, you're going to be paying more. If you use less, you would pay a little less. In Florida, Progress Energy Florida, in testimony on the plants, indicated that by 2021, Progress Energy Florida ratepayers would be paying $717 per year for the two units, and this is even before delivery of the two units. And again, this is at the estimate of $22.5 billion. So obviously, if the cost increases, if costs increase for either or both plants, that would have an impact on ratepayers. Sort of grossly simplifying the analogy, this would almost be like you hiring a contractor to build a house where you don't know when the house will be completed and you don't know the final contract amount, and in the meantime, you're also paying for the contractor's financing costs up front, to sort of grossly simplify this analogy. Next slide. Clearly, there are better alternatives than these proposed nuclear power plants. First off, energy efficiency. Georgia has no energy efficiency target. Florida actually reduced its targets this past year. And in the most recent survey of sort of the 50 states, the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, ACEEE, sort of ranked all 50 states. And you can see on this chart that Florida is ranked 34th, Georgia is ranked 45th in sort of per capita energy efficiency spending. It is well below the U.S. average, and compared to the 10 states with the highest per capita spending on energy efficiency, it is well below those 10 states. As further context, I believe that Florida spent a total of $123.2 million on energy efficiency programs across the state, and Georgia, again in the ACEEE website, spent $21.6 million in energy efficiency. And this is in comparison to the $14.1 billion and $22.5 billion for the two proposed plants. Next slide. for renewables, there clearly is ample opportunity for Georgia and Florida to make progress. 29 states have renewable energy targets. 8 states have goals. Neither Georgia nor Florida have sort of renewable portfolio standards or goals. One point that has been made in the past has been that the reason why the Southeast has lagged is because there have been claims that the Southeast does not have as much renewable energy potential as other parts of the country. But in our research, we find that that is not the case. Next slide. In Florida, in 2008, the Florida Public Service Commission actually commissioned Navigant Consulting to prepare a study to identify renewable energy potential in the state. The study is available on the Florida PSC website, and I've sort of included a hyperlink for anyone interested. And in that study, Navigant identified sort of a technical potential of 136,000 megawatts to 142,000 megawatts of renewable energy potential in the state by 2020. And this is in comparison to the current Florida electric generating capacity of 59,000 megawatts and Levy 1 and 2's projected capacity of 2,200 megawatts. While this is technical potential, the actual potential is going to be contingent on policy choices made by Florida to promote or, unfortunately, as the case is currently, not promote renewable energy in the state. But clearly, there is significant potential in Florida to meet its electricity demands through renewable energy from in-state sources. And next slide. While Florida has commissioned a study on renewable energy potential, unfortunately, that has not been the case in Georgia. Georgia has not commissioned a study. The Georgia Public Service Commission has not commissioned a study. So in the absence of a sort of state commission study, we looked to other sources. And in 2009, SACE conducted a study of renewable energy potential in the Southeast, and which included Georgia, and we used the results from that study to help inform what renewable energy potential is available in Georgia. That study identified by 2025 that there is 99,000 gigawatt hours of electricity available in the state from renewable energy sources. Georgia's current generation is 128,000 gigawatt hours. So clearly, there is potential to meet a significant portion of Georgia's future electricity needs. And as a point of comparison, the annual generation from Vogtle 3 and 4 is anticipated to be about 16,380 gigawatt hours. So the renewable energy potential in Georgia is there. It's just a matter of will and sort of policy choices to sort of harness that potential. Next slide. So sort of in conclusion for Georgia, we found that the redaction and lack of transparency in the Georgia power estimates for Vogtle 3 and 4 troubling, and that we believe that it is very likely that that Vogtle 3 and 4 will see delays and cost increases. And I believe there have been some recent press releases already indicating that prior to approval, prior to any major construction, the timeline for Vogtle 3 and 4 is going to slip by 5 months, and that there are already some cost overruns experience. And again, this is prior to any major work already. So with that, we have our mid-range estimate. Again, that mid-range estimate is above energy efficiency, renewable energy resources, and even conventional generation. Georgia Power ratepayers will be paying approximately $120 per year by 2018 in financing charges at the current estimate. And should costs increase, then the impact on consumer bills, customer bills will also increase. There is ample energy efficiency potential and renewable energy potential in Georgia that could be utilized to meet electricity demand growth that is both low cost and would help serve to diversify Georgia's electricity generation resources. And that Georgia should take immediate steps to identify renewable energy potential and energy efficiency potential. The last energy efficiency potential study for the state was done in 2005, and there has not been a sort of statewide analysis of renewable energy potential in the state. Next slide. For Florida, the announcements of the cost increases and project delays is clearly troubling. We don't think that those cost increases and delays will be the last that have been announced. Our mid-range cost estimate of $164 per megawatt hour is well above the mid-range cost estimate for alternatives. Energy has stated that at $22.5 billion, the impact on ratepayers will be $718 per year by 2021, and that's even before it generates a single kilowatt hour of electricity. Again, that's at the $22.5 billion cost estimate, so if cost estimates increase, then the impact on ratepayers will increase. Florida has, again, like Georgia, significant energy efficiency and renewable energy potential that is currently untapped, and that both Florida and Georgia can meet demand growth through available and low-cost renewable energy and energy efficiency that are better alternatives than the two proposed projects. And with that, thank you, and I guess I'll turn it over to you, Chandra.
Okay, well, thank you. We have a couple of statements that I'll read off really quickly and have you guys respond that have come in the question section. We're now in the question and answer session. You may either ask questions by typing them in the question bar on the right-hand side of your control panel, or you may also do *6 to unmute your line and ask the question verbally. First, let me get to these statements that came in earlier for me to read off. One statement that came in was that recent bids on Progress Energy's RFP for solar PV came in at $60 for 110 megawatt hours.
Yep, and one of the things, so one of the, this is Max, one of the interesting things just to respond is that generally technologies as they sort of advance, there is a learning curve, and you're seeing that especially in solar and in wind where the installed costs are coming down. What's interesting is that the historical analysis of nuclear has been the complete opposite, whereas as newer plants are developed, the costs have actually increased. So there was a recent study in electricity policy that actually analyzed the French nuclear power industry experience, and their conclusion was that there is negative learning for nuclear power.
And a question just came in response to that, Max. It says, I use similar reasoning about reduction in electricity demand, but now people are asking me about projections that factor electric cars. Clearly, we all prefer solar electric cars, but did Synapse include anything about this?
In our analysis, we did not project sort of any increased demand from sort of electric vehicles. We were relying on, for our sort of electricity demand, we were relying on company-reported information. In the case of Progress, they provide sort of projections for electricity demand every year in their 10-year site plans. And in the case of Georgia Power, their electricity load projections were actually redacted. So what we did was we actually took growth rates based on Georgia Power's sort of analyst, Wall Street analyst conference calls, where Georgia Power sort of made broad projections about electricity demand growth to Wall Street. And we used those growth figures to sort of estimate demand, future demand for Georgia Power.
Question? Good question here?
Sure.
This is Gary Morgan from Scottsboro. Of course, we've got a couple of AP1000s that's planned here whenever the in long-term future. Just got a couple of questions for the Synapse guy, and appreciate it. Excellent presentation. Some costs that we're not mentioning, and that is, and I'm kind of curious of why these costs are not mentioned, the decommissioning costs, the waste storage costs, and also security costs. And also another cost factor I had a question about as I was looking through there. It is, Synapse says the emissions cost is zero, but of course, in the fuel manufacturing, we know there are considerable emissions that goes into the fuel cycle. So is there any particular reasons that the decommissioning, the storage costs and security costs, and then the emissions costs reflected zero?
Yes, I mean, and that's a very excellent question and excellent point. We did not look at sort of life cycle costs, precisely those costs that you sort of indicated, the decommissioning, the fuel processing. We were sort of mainly just the scope of our work was sort of just focusing on the sort of electricity generation side. Those costs are very real, and they would have the impact of increasing the life cycle costs of those two plants, of the projects, but again, we just did not quantify. We didn't have enough information to quantify them in this particular report.
Hey, thanks. Just one more comment. I'm going to tell you why the Southeast does not or is errant in way low on energy efficiency, and that is because of our ultra-conservative politicians we have in the Southeast. If you'll notice the breakdown for the political federal office holders, they are primarily ultra-conservative, and they support the nuclear industry. They support coal, and they support fossil fuels. And of course, there's a reason they do this, because they're reaping the rewards from their stock holdings. And as I've pointed out to some other folks, until we make an attack, and if you believe in energy efficiency, if you believe in clean energy, it is necessary to literally attack the politicians that are supporting dirty electrical generation, which includes nuclear. Until that happens, we will not be able to move our society, particularly in the Southeast, towards clean, renewable, sustainable energy forms. Well, that's my two cents worth.
Thank you, Gary.
So we have a few
more
comments.
Questions?
We do. So first, I did want to note that we've had a few questions about where to get the presentation slides. And Sarah, I'm just telling everybody to visit the cleanenergy.org website later on this week, and they'll be up along with the audio.
You'll also have a link
yes,
to the report. You'll also have a link to the report in the same place?
We will, but if people need things more quickly, because we are dealing with some technical issues, you can email me at Sarah, S-A-R-A, at cleanenergy.org, and I can email you the PDF of this presentation. And once we have the audio available, I can include that as well. There may be a delay on this getting loaded up onto the SACE website, just due to some technical issues. So feel free to email me if you want it, Sarah at cleanenergy.org.
And it's also posted on the Synapse website as well.
Yes.
Right. Thank you. Okay. To continue on with some of these other questions and comments, the issue with levelized nukes is 4,000 per year are off peak, where there are no shortage and market prices are 40 to 50 megawatt hours. So nukes are forcing the market to accept inframarginal products for 50% of the year. This commenter suggests levelizing the calculation to amortize over on-peak hours only. This will drive up the effective levelized cost of nukes.
Oh, so I guess this question is directed to me. So what we did is we actually, the analysis assumes, and it's actually documented in the full report, but we did take into account sort of the levelization period is a 20-year period for all of the technologies, accounting for the different capacity factors for each technology. So we tried to, it's a very good point that nuclear power is baseload generation, whereas some of the solar PV for in particular is peaking generation capacity. So we did recognize that there is a slight mismatch between peaking and baseload, and we tried to adjust for those factors during the levelization calculations.
And this is a continuation of the comment. By the way, JEA, JEA has a deal to power about 10% of its electric grid annually using about 200 megawatts of electricity bought from two reactors being added at the Georgia Power Company's Vogtle plant near Waynesboro, Georgia. Construction of non-nuclear structures has already begun, and the first reactor will go online in 2016. By 2017 if the plant receives federal authorization. And the commenter goes on to say that he's working with companies that can provide solar PV rooftop residential at an effective price well below 100 megawatt hours, megawatts per hour, well below the cost estimates of Levy. And then a follow-up question from the same person there is that their question about Progress Energy's uprate, does the $717 annual price include gross receipts, tax, franchise fee, and municipal utility tax, these add 16% to the base charges. I think that, Max, that's obviously for you.
Yep. Now, the $717 is just the nuclear cost recovery charge. So that's just the plants. I'm not as familiar with Progress Energy's Florida's rate schedule, so the other components may actually increase because of the charge, but I'm not entirely sure of that.
Another question we have here is, why not compare or contrast Vogtle with BC Summer in South Carolina? They're each AP 1000 plants, but different bids. But Vogtle is a fixed bid. VC Summer is a cost-plus bid.
I'll answer that. This is because, I mean, basically we had a limited amount of money, and we had enough money to compare two reactors and you know, two reactor sets. If we had more money, we would have gladly done additional comparisons and analyses, but, resources are resources.
Another question is, has
go ahead, Sandra. It's fine.
Has any nuclear project in the U.S., either completed or currently proposed, actually been built at the initial projected cost?
I'm not aware of any, but, I mean, some have come in much closer to their projections than others. You'd have to go back and look at the entire data set, but the trend and the overwhelming evidence is that on average, in the 70s and 80s, the nuclear power plants that were built during that period came in on average at 200% over their estimated costs.
And a follow-up to that, Ellen, is there a general number we can cite on the average increase in cost projections for nuclear plants?
Well, again, it's very difficult to do that in terms of what was actually built, we use the 200%, but, you know, that covers a whole range. You know, Vogel is often quoted as being 1,200% over its original estimates, but, of course, that didn't factor in the time value of money. The problem with the plants we're dealing with now is nothing's been built. So until if something actually gets built, you know, that will provide us with a data point. But given that nobody really believes we'll see more than a couple of these actually come online, it's going to be very difficult, and it'll be years. It'll be a decade. I mean, I know Southern is saying 2016, 2017, but I don't know that anybody believes that, including Southern Company, but of course they'll stick to that until they're forced to change it. As far as Flamanville, you know, they're practically the EPRs in Europe and Flamanville and what's the other one? I'm blanking.
Finland,
Olkiluoto. Those are both horribly delayed and over budget, but that, of course, is a different design. And then you've got the plants in China where we've heard there are some delays, but, of course, given that it's being built in China by the Chinese government, even those if those plants went vastly over budget, I'm not sure we'd ever get the facts to know exactly how much.
If I could make a quick comment, this is Jamie Whitlock. I'm an attorney for SACE. I represent SACE in front of the Florida Public Service Commission regarding early cost recovery for the Levy Project. And Ellen just made a really good point that I wanted to add on regarding the projected in-service dates of these various proposed reactors. It came out in testimony this year, and I found it very interesting that these companies, stick hard and fast to these estimated in-service dates. And the reason they do that is because they want the NRC to continue to process their combined operating license applications in a timely fashion. So, for example, you know, if they said, well, we're looking at 2027, 2029, the NRC would have no impetus to exert resources at this point to process their applications. So it's in the utility's best interest, to keep the public face out that, hey, we're set on 2016, 2017, 2021, 2022, what have you. And that's because they want the NRC to go ahead and process their application, hopefully get approved, and then at that point, if the in-service dates change, there's really no repercussions for that.
We have a couple questions here related to Levy. As an intervener at Levy, we were told that the business of PEF is electrical generation, so they were not required to consider energy efficiency. And a different question related to Levy was that what were the reasons for the cost delays?
The cost delays or the construction delays?
The question was cost delays. They named it construction delays.
Well, as I understand it, the reason for the construction delay is that the expected demand for power in the state has dramatically declined as a result of the recession, the collapse of the housing market in the state, the actual exodus of people for the first time. I can't recall if it was 2010, but that was the first year that Florida had experienced negative population growth since World War II. So of course, the assumptions the utility made in justifying this plant in 2006 have essentially fallen apart. So rather than scrap the plant, they've just pushed it back to where the demand projections match what they say they need to build the plant.
And I think Ellen's right. This is Jamie Whitlock. In addition to Ellen's point about demand, there was also a lot of regulatory uncertainty regarding approval of the AP1000 design, which there still is some, and that also played a role in the construction delays as well.
Well, and this is Sarah Barzak of Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, and I think Mary Olson with Nuclear Information Resource Service is or was on the call. She's led an excellent effort challenging the construction operating, the combined operating license a challenge at the NRC, and one of the things that did impact progress on their schedule is that the NRC did not approve their limited work authorization, or rather said that it wasn't really very good, and progress withdrew the LWA request, and that would have allowed them to do some of the work that's been done at the Vogtle site in advance of actually getting the COL, and that some of that work is quite extensive. If you looked at that slide in Max's presentation, that was a picture of the Vogtle site currently, and you can see there's a very large amount of construction going on site. So that LWA not being approved impacted progress's schedule as well. So it's a combination of a lot of regulatory things, and then, to be honest, I think some real incompetency issues on the part of progress.
Hey, Sarah, I have a question for you. I guess I'm allowed to ask one. Do you know why that Southern was granted that and progress wasn't?
I don't know. I think it's a little bit of an apples to oranges comparison. Southern Nuclear put together their application for the LWA and their request in such a way that it met the criteria and the needs that the NRC staff needed in order to recommend approval and ultimately to get approval from the NRC. So my understanding is that progress didn't basically have a very strong case, and there were lots of questions that came up about the site itself, which, again, Mary Olson is an expert on with the site for the Levy County reactors is just extremely problematic. So I think progress had a couple things going against it, whereas Vogtle, Southern Nuclear had its application, you know, in the sense that the NRC needed to analyze it and approve it.
Yeah, and this is Jamie. Sarah's right. The Levy site, and I think it was in particular hydrogeological issues that they could not answer to the NRC's satisfaction in order to receive the limited work authorization, and I think those concerns and some other site-specific concerns played into the denial of that request.
And Mary Olson is there, and she's trying to unmute. I just sent her the instructions.
I'm unmuted now. Can you hear me?
Yep. Yeah? Go ahead,
yep.
Mary.
I just wanted to add a brief comment that we have a panel of atomic safety licensing judges who admitted our hydroecological contention before the question of the limited work authorization was decided, and it's one of the widest NEPA contentions that I'm aware of ever having made it into a licensing proceeding. And clearly the type of work that is happening at Vogtle would intersect with the issues we're raising. So I think that there's an effort at NRC to have a credible licensing hearing, and that's part of why that was rejected.
Thank you, Mary.
All right. Another question that we have here is, can we apply cost increases to current and projected rate schedules and compare to non-nuclear states and southeastern rates?
It's outside of the scope of the study, but obviously, again, anything could be done if we can come up with the funds to do it. One of the things that I think would be interesting to do as a future project would be to take the current rates of the Southeast states that brag about how competitive their electricity prices are compared to the rest of the nation, and then compare those to what those rates will look like if and when reactors, the proposed reactors actually came online.
And this is Sarah. I think most of the people on the call know this, but it's important to know that both in Georgia and Florida, as long as these costs are prudently incurred, these, you know, advanced or early cost recovery costs, and they're approved by the respective public service commissions, if Vogtle 3 and 4 or maybe only Vogtle 3 comes online, or Levy 1 and 2 are completely abandoned, there's no refund to ratepayers. So you could see rate increases with no corresponding electricity production, which would be an interesting asterisk to see on your electric bill.
If they allow you to see a separate line item on your electric bill.
Yeah, and I was going to point that out for the folks in Georgia that are on the line, and even for those in Florida. I know we've got some folks from North Carolina and South Carolina on the line too. If you're a Georgia Power ratepayer, one of the few things that we managed to get that I would label as a victory that came out of the last big Georgia Power rate case is, if you look on your bills, you'll see a line item now that says nuclear construction cost recovery. And so you can see your monthly charge for those Vogtle reactors, these upfront and advanced charges. And I think it would be something that other states, other PSCs, that would be something you could contact your commissioners and ask for that type of bill labeling. Bear in mind, though, that in Georgia you also list a lot of other things, like what you may be paying for, say, green energy blocks of power or environmental compliance costs or, you know, upgrades to old coal plants and stuff like that. But I think it would be really valuable for people in all of these states that have construction work in progress, like the southern states do, to have that listed on people's bills.
Yeah, that's a point. Interesting. We are, just so people on the phone know, I am working with outreach folks in Florida to bring around the results of this study as it's relevant to Levy, and I actually testified before a Senate Energy and Utilities Subcommittee this morning on the alternatives to new nuclear. But one of the things I learned over the last 2 days talking with various state representatives is there is no separate line item that shows customers in Florida what their Levy charges are, which I think would be very helpful. So if there's, you know, lessons learned in terms of how that was accomplished in Georgia, I'm sure allies in South Carolina and Florida and North Carolina would also welcome that.
All right, we have a few more questions left. Max and Ellen, are you okay to stay with us for another few minutes while we try to get
I can stay on until 1:45.
Okay. Max, are you okay?
I'm okay.
Okay. Has Synapse or UCS or SAVE developed or are working on a comprehensive sustainable energy plan to replace nuclear and fossil fuels, or any such plan in the works?
Well, UCS came up with a climate blueprint 2030 in 2009 that laid out a roadmap for how we could accomplish that utilizing an aggressive renewable energy portfolio standard combined with very aggressive energy efficiency measures. That analysis, which was a national analysis that showed that how one pathway for doing this, certainly not the only pathway, is posted on our website, and it's called Blueprint 2030.
And to add to that, to UCS's report, Synapse just produced a published a report in the middle of November titled Toward a Sustainable Future for the U.S. Power Sector Beyond Business as Usual, and that looks at retiring the existing coal fleet and significantly reducing the U.S. nuclear fleet and looking at alternatives for more aggressive energy efficiency and renewables across the country. And that report's available on our website.
And I'd like to point something else out to the folks in the Southeast that just got announced yesterday. Entergy has agreed to sell its entire transmission system to American Transmission Company. So it that move, it will take several years to actually unfold and implement, or at least 18 months, but probably closer to 2 years. But the significance of that is that by replacing a vertically integrated utility with a independent transmission company that has no allegiance to any particular generating source, that is one of the first major cracks or entrees I've seen into the Southeastern electricity market in my lifetime. So that combined with the planning requirements that came out of FERC Order 1000 2 months ago, there's going to be opportunities for movement and changes in terms of integrating alternative kinds of generation that are not owned by utilities, but it's going to take some time.
Another question is, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tony.
This is Gary in Scottsboro. I'm reading, as I'm listening here, I'm reading NEI Smart Brief. Just noticed, let's see, now Levy is a Progress Energy project, right?
Yes,
correct.
Well, not any longer.
What do you mean?
I see here NRC, the headline is NRC clears turnover of Progress Energy's reactors to Duke Energy.
Well, it doesn't surprise me, but that also probably means that Jim Rogers is probably not going to pursue Levy. I think he's more interested in Summer.
Well, I was going to say that's probably a result of the merger of the two. Those two companies have Progress, Duke and Progress have merged.
Right. All right.
And I agree with Ellen. Yeah, I think it's highly questionable whether Levy's going to be a priority once that once the merged company, once that becomes final.
This was in the American City Business Journals. Is the source of this.
Thank you, Gary, for pointing that out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sandra, I know Ellen said she needs to jump off, so is there Max and Jamie and I might be able to stay on a little bit longer, but we may want to wrap up unless there's, you know, one or two burning questions left.
Sure, just a couple questions about, I think, some specific people's, some places that some specific people are asking about. One is there any chance to do a similar report on the proposed Duke Lee reactor in South Carolina?
Well,
it's
certainly possible, but I don't think we can address that
for it.
Sorry.
<Yeah.
laughs> Anything's possible, but again, it's a matter of marshaling the resources to do it. As Matt can attest, this was a very extensive and you know, complicated effort, and we didn't even do a fraction of what you would do to actually come up with a cost-effective integrated resource plan for a state or a region, which would require a whole another level of effort. But it's a valid question. It should be done. It's just a question of who could take that on.
Yeah, and this is Jamie. I think, you know, the general lessons learned and the general recommendations and the general premises of this report can be applied to all proposed new nuclear reactors as well, as far as cost escalation, scheduling delay, those types of things.
Agreed. And what it also gives you is two perspectives. One is a greenfield
right.
plant, and one is in addition to an existing plant. So you've got both examples there.
Right.
Maybe the numbers have to be changed to protect
sure.
the innocent.
And you also have... You also have the, just to add to Ellen's point, is you also have the impact of federal subsidies on one plant versus the other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another, this is Sarah, that's another reason why Vogtle shouldn't necessarily be looked at as the example to turn to, because it has some unique characteristics that are pointed out in this report that Max elaborated on. So, you know, I know there's all eyes on Vogtle, but Vogtle has some unique things like the production tax credit, the offer of the loan guarantee that others don't. So that's important.
Well, not only that, but they're
dealing
with five-year-old cost data, which we all know is patently false.
A final question as it relates to Vogtle and the tax credit issue, and this will be the last one we'll have a chance to get to today. Since they're getting subsidies, is there any way we can require Georgia Power to provide docs without redactions as they relate to the overall cost factor, since tax and ratepayers are
are incurring and seem to be responsible for these costs?
I don't know. This is Sarah. I don't know that there's a mechanism that we, the public, has to require Georgia Power to release that information. You know, there's a process that utilities have to go through when they're before their public service commissions to say what is redacted and what is not, and what requires you signing a confidentiality agreement and what doesn't. And I would think an influence would be more on the Public Service Commission and saying that, you know, this has to be more of a transparent process. But I think Jamie might be able to answer this better legally is, you know, that's the way the rules are written.
Yeah, and unfortunately, Sarah, given that it's Georgia, you know, I don't know exactly what the legal reporting requirements are there.
Let's put it this way. Publicly, the lead, you know, according to the nuclear industry, Vogtle is the lead reactor project in the country, and it's having to move forward based on under, you know, it's not a transparent process. It's requiring massive taxpayer handouts and reducing ratepayer protections. And if that's what it takes to build a new reactor in the U.S., that doesn't seem like a very fair model.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I think we are done. Great presentation, everyone. Thank you all for attending today. We had a great attendance, great discussion. As I said, the webinar series is a great way for us to connect with you. Remember that the audio portion of today's webinar, along with the presentations, will ultimately be available under our webinars tab at the www.cleanenergy.org. Link for Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, or you can email me, as I said, directly at sarah@cleanenergy.org. So with that, thank you for attending today. Thanks for your questions. Thanks to all of our speakers. We appreciate your support of Southern Alliance for Clean Energy and look forward to hearing from you. And Sandra, if you could please stop recording the webinar at this time, and thank you for your help. I would appreciate it. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.